fly fishing, your fly line is a long, supple weight, which actually does catch. This line is heavy, and you have a fly that's lighter than the line, that you can unroll this line as a weight, and it will unroll to the target. So what we're doing with fly casting, we're not really casting the line, we're unrolling it.
Lefty Cray is arguably the world's best fly fisherman. And as you're about to hear, he's also lived a fascinating life, and he's a great storyteller, too. Welcome to a special co-production of The Signal and Maryland Traditions. I'm Aaron Henkin here with folklorist Cliff Murphy. Cliff and I had the pleasure of spending a day with Lefty Cray, and this hour we're going to share some highlights from that visit. And Cliff, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Sir, as a professional folklorist, I wonder if you might talk about exactly what your interest is in this man, Lefty Cray.
Well, I grew up fly fishing, and my stepfather was visiting one weekend from New Hampshire, and I took him to Tochterman's Tackle in East Baltimore, where they have an in-house fly tire in the upstairs. And so we were up there talking to the guy tying flies, and he mentioned to me that Lefty Cray lived in Maryland, and I knew who Lefty was, and my stepfather knew that he was a rock star of fly fishermen. And I had no idea, and so I took it upon myself to seek him out. And when we met, what I learned about Lefty is that he's really one of these individuals that I come across in my work who kind of stands at this intersection of culture, landscape, and craft. You know, he makes fishing flies, but these are things that are based on observations of nature. He can explain the landscape to you. He can explain the culture of fishing to you, and he can teach you, and he loves to teach.
We're going to hear a lot of incredible stories from Lefty Cray during the hour ahead, and I thought we would start with this one. This is Lefty talking about one of the most beautiful places he has ever fished.
I fished all over the world. My favorite place is New Guinea. There's things there you don't see anywhere else. For example, I was in the Amazon 6 months ago, and it's fantastic, but it's nothing like, you don't really see much wildlife in the Amazon. The animals are back in the jungle, but in New Guinea, they're everywhere. I think they called it an Alectus parrot. There's a female that's a brilliant green. It's almost like the green in a mallard duck. And we were on the Zulu River in New Britain, which is a big island part of New Guinea. And clouds of these things would come over almost a half a block in size of these brilliant green parrots. And they're all yakking the whole time they're flying. And these literally were like green clouds flying overhead for 4 or 5 minutes sometime. And then would come all the males would be flying along behind. Well, you see hornbills that have look like their bill would make them topple over in the air. All kinds of animals and stuff. It's the most interesting place I've ever fished.
To hear you talk about experiences like that, it makes me wonder if the fishing experience is so much about the fish or just about being out in the environment where you are.
I think somebody who's had a lot of experience in fishing, when they want to catch a lot of fish. And then they want to catch a big fish. And then they want to catch the hard-to-catch fish. And then I think and I've felt this way for many years, my greatest pleasure in fishing now is to take somebody that's never done it and coax them into how to do the thing and then watch them catch their first one of whatever it is. And to me, it's kind of like catching the thing yourself all over again. Once you've caught a lot of fish, catching the fish anymore, to me anymore, 90% of fishing is who I fish with and the environment I'm fishing in. 10% is whether you catch fish or not.
I heard an expression that if you really want to know a man, you should take him fishing. Is that your experience?
I would say if you spend a day in a boat with a guy, you know whether he's an anal orifice or a really nice guy. Yes. One day in a boat will tell you a whole lot about a person. Yeah.
Fly fisherman Lefty Cray talking with us at his home in Cockeysville, Maryland. Lefty is 90 years old, and he is irrepressible. He's still fishing, still tying flies, still writing books. I think he's on his 32nd book right now, as a matter of fact, still traveling the world. And when we paid him a visit, he showed off a new 5-year calendar that he'd just bought and told us, "I'm an optimist." Aaron Henkin here with folklorist Cliff Murphy. And Cliff, let's turn back the calendar now to Lefty's early years. He was born in Frederick, Maryland, back in 1925.
Yeah, so this was right on the brink of the Depression. Lefty was the oldest of 4 kids. His father died when he was 6. And so the family was left, in Lefty's words, destitute. They went on relief, and the government provided certain material things, you know, some food subsidy. Well,
right. Relief is different than welfare. Right?
Yeah.
Welfare, as we know it, is, you know, this financial support. Relief was material support.
Right. So you would get coal for your heating. You would get food deliveries and those kinds of things. But you never got money. And Frederick was a small town at the time, too. You know, I mean, this is like 5,000-6,000 people. So there was very little separation between kind of the urban center of Frederick and the countryside. So it was easy to get to rivers. And also, everybody knew everybody's business. So everybody knew who was on relief and who wasn't.
So what this all leads up to, Cliff, is that, as we're about to hear, Lefty became a commercial fisherman, I guess you could say, at a relatively young age.
Yeah, just so resourceful and really seemed to shape his life.
In those days, children could go out and not the parents wouldn't have to worry about them. So me and my 2 brothers, Dick and Ted, we would walk out to Monoxie, and I had a friend that would lend us a boat, no motor on it. I learned to pole when I was about 8 years old. And when I got to high school, we were so poor, we didn't have enough money to buy mosquito underwear. And so we really, when I got to high school, my mother said, if you can get enough money to pay for your books or your clothes and your lunch, you can go to school. And of course, in those days, young people could work. So there's a thing called bush bobbing in Maryland where at night, if you hang a mason line down so that the bait is just under the water, suspended from tree branches, the catfish will come along at night and feed on those. And of course, you have no idea how many fish were in our rivers 50 years ago. I mean, it was incredible. And they were paying 5 cents a pound for dressed catfish at the market over in Frederick. So I bush bobbed, and I could always find somebody to go with me, and we'd stay overnight down in Durr's Woods and near outside of Frederick. And I made more money than anybody I know. I was the fat cat in high school. But I've been fishing ever since. My brothers and I have been fishing together ever since we could almost walk.
Who took you fishing the first time you went fishing?
We walked. We took ourselves. Yeah. We learned it all on our own. There were so many freshwater mussels in the rivers then. The freshwater mussels that looked like an elongated oyster, they would crawl along and they left a track. And so we used them for bait. And you could literally walk in any decent sized stream in Maryland, Tomek and all of them, and in Monoxie. And we'd pick up 75 or 100 mussels and put them in a backwater. And then we'd come back the next day in the afternoon and we'd shell them, put them in a surf bucket, and we put these hook. You didn't put those bush bobs out in the daytime because the turtles would eat the bait off of them. You put them out at night, and we used coil oil lanterns. In fact, the hatches of bugs were so great then that we had to use 2 coil oil lanterns because bugs would be attracted to the light, and the oxygen for the light was at the bottom, and it would shut it down. So when that was starting to shut down, we'd light the other lantern. The insect life that was along our rivers and the animals and creatures, all this stuff is gone. I mean, there was a thing called an American toad that every night on all of our rivers, you hear this rock, rock, rock. Thousands and thousands of toads calling each other. I haven't heard one of them in 30 years. We've lost so much wildlife here, it's unbelievable. The water table is down over 3 feet in Frederick County because of development. We used to float to Monoxie from the top up at the Pennsylvania line all the way to You couldn't float to Monoxia now more than 100 yards had to get out and drag a boat.
An outdoorsman with enough years of experience to have personally witnessed some radical changes in the natural environment, Lefty Cray. Now, right after high school, Lefty went into the military, and Cliff Murphy, Lefty, when we talked with him, told us some fascinating stories about his time in the war.
Yeah, Lefty went into basic training in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, and then shipped out to France, where his group wound up being replacements for casualties in the Battle of the Bulge. So he just went right into the thick of it.
This is we're gonna drop in here on a story he's telling about being in that battle in the middle of winter.
We were trapped in a field where you dug slit trenches, and which were just dirt slot holes, rectangular holes. You left the dirt seat to sit on. It was 12 degrees at night, and there was about a foot of snow on the ground. We're sitting there for 7 days because the fog was so thick. You couldn't see 100 yards. The Germans couldn't move. We couldn't move. They'd throw artillery to us. When you did, you just ducked down. The bad thing is that, in fact, if you sat on this dirt seat, it was 12 degrees, it would melt the water in the ground. When you stood up, you had a pancake ice on the rear end. The big thing is we lost, and I never heard this mentioned in television, we lost more men to trench foot, which is where they have to take the feet off because they freeze. And I got, not real bad, but I got frostbitten toes and feet, and I really don't like cold weather at all anymore. But we would sleep with, we had two pairs of socks, so we put one pair under our arms at night so they would dry out so we'd have them the next day. When the 7 days of that, and the next day there was not a cloud in the sky, and you've seen birds in the fall migrating. When we looked up, it looked like that with airplanes coming over, from our planes. And, of course, they knocked all the tanks out, the Germans, but some of the planes dove down over our outfit, and they released parachutes that were about a third the size of a normal parachute that had a canister on the bottom, which was insulated. And we ran out and opened them up. And, of course, all we'd been eating is canned cold food for 7 days, and they had these canisters had hot syrup in them with pancakes floating around. We ate like hot dogs. But the best part was the other canisters had dry socks, which is what we needed best of all. Then we just went on from there, and we were at the Remagen Bridge. They had just blown it when we got there, but they had put I wouldn't call it a bridge, but a bunch of floats with with boards on top of them. And we drove over these things, and you can imagine driving a truck with little, I mean, I got rope burns saying my rotary is so fast going over that thing, I'll tell you. Anyway, we got over the other side, and we went through Germany, and we ended up in Leipzig liberating a concentration camp. And our outfit, the 69th Division, was the one that met the Russians on the Elbe River.
You're tuned to The Signal. I'm Aaron Henkin, here with Cliff Murphy, and this hour we're sharing some highlights from a day spent with world-renowned fly fisherman Lefty Cray. And Cliff, it really is a special feeling to be able to sit down in a room with a man Lefty's age and to hear firsthand these personal accounts of such monumental moments from history, isn't it?
It is, and you know, he's such a visual person, you know, that, you know, you get this, you get the images with the details and the colors, you know.
And describing the airplane, the U.S. planes coming in as a flock of migrating birds, it's through an outdoorsman's eye that he's seeing war.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, he explained to us, too, how, I don't know, there's some elaborate point system for people who had seen duty in terms of the end of the European front and, you know, being shipped back home and winding
up. Right. Who got to get back home when it became clear that the war was about to be won?
Yeah. And so Lefty winds up back in Frederick expecting to go to Japan. And they get the news that, you know, the Japanese have surrendered. And, you know, the picture that he painted for us really of the celebration in downtown Frederick, you know, people hugging and kissing in the street and that kind of thing, just really was pretty moving, actually.
Yeah, so there's this scene of celebration here in his hometown, and just by coincidence, he's one of the first guys back. And so he ends up, he tells us, Cliff, Being one of the first guys to like get in line for a civilian job, he got hired at Fort Detrick, which had just at that point switched from being a military to a civilian base.
Quasi-civilian, right?
Quasi-civilian. I mean,
right, because they're growing chemical weapons at Fort Detrick. And Lefty, he made a crack to us about how he always thought Bill was a guy's name until he got married. You know, so the war ends and he needs to get a job. And this is the job that he gets. And it's growing anthrax.
They had a thing called a pilot plant, which grew 1,800 gallons of anthrax, tularemia, psittacosis, these bad diseases. And what they did, we would concentrate that with centrifuges into a mud that we would transport, would be transported to the site. We were like we grew the crop of bacteria that the scientists worked on. That building took 25 years to be declassified. It took that long. It just tore it down a few years ago. But what we would do is these tanks were seven stories high, and when it was ready to be harvested, it would come out a one-inch pipe, go into these centrifuges that spend 60,000 RPMs, and we would take mud out of there, this liquid, this basic pure anthrax mud. We took it out with ladies' spatulas, using it. Well, I had a suit on, and apparently we had a tear in it, and I got anthrax. And two other guys got it in their lungs, and they both died. I got it in my arm, which turned black, and I was in the hospital for quite a while with it, and eventually they got over. Anyway, the New York Times came down here about 6 or 8 years ago when all this anthrax went. If they can take a bacteria and get it out of your body, it's more virulent on the next person. So they were able to isolate that stuff from me, and I found out when the New York Times came out here a few years ago and when all this anthrax scared, I found that my initials are BVK. The last 8 years I was at Detrick, I was growing a BVK strain of anthrax, which they have now kept in case they ever need it again.
Can you imagine that? Your own strain of anthrax named after you. It's a dubious claim to fame. But Lefty Cray, I guess, would go on from there to earn other claims to fame, more positive claims to fame. He is revered around the world today as quite possibly the very best fly fisherman on the planet. And Cliff Murphy, Lefty's career as a sportsman really began as a career as a writer, didn't it?
Yeah, the shift work that he did at Fort Detrick gave him an opportunity to do a lot of hunting and fishing that he might not have been able to do with a regular 9-to-5 kind of job. He started, you know, got approached by the local newspaper in Frederick, the Frederick News Post, who had heard of his reputation as an outdoorsman. And they asked him if he would write an outdoor column. And this grew into a pretty substantial job for him. He wrote for a number of different papers, the Montgomery County Sentinel, the Winchester Star, Towson County Paper. And the same journalist at the Frederick News Post also got Lefty into photography, you know, actually taking his own photographs with a 35 millimeter camera, which at that time was somewhat cutting edge, you know, and
he's remained passionate about photography. He loves cameras.
Absolutely.
He was an early adopter.
Yeah.
And as we're about to hear, his high-tech camera actually kind of gave him a leg up as an outdoors writer.
The magazines in those days, there was only four hunting and fishing magazines in the United States. It was Field & Stream, Sports & Field, Outdoor Life, and Fur Fishing Game in Nebraska. Well, if you wrote about a hunting or fishing thing for these big magazines, nobody was putting the photographs in because they weren't carrying these great big clumsy Graffexes and all around. So they had to hire an artist to illustrate the story. So they were going to pay you for the story, but they were going to put more money in an artist to illustrate it. I started sending my own black and white photographs along with my coach. So I got a jump on almost all the guys in the outdoor writing field. But where that really helped me was I started getting lots of slides on fishing. And I really have always believed in writing about how to, where to, what to. I got a high school education, and I never knew how to write them pretty stories in a way I'm glad I didn't. Anyway, I was the first one that I know of to decide I need to know more about what's just around Maryland and West Virginia and Pennsylvania. So I started with the very first one doing clinics on fishing, fly fishing mostly, but all kind of fishing. I started doing these clinics, and people would pay you to get to the clinic, and then they would pay you something for being there, and I would always arrange. I had the greatest wife in the world, and she understood, and I would take a day or two and stay over, and I would be able to fish with the top man in Bozeman, Montana, or Saskatchewan, or all that. I got to fish all over the world on somebody else's money, and today, if you want to know how to catch a barramundi in Australia, I know where to go for it. Or if you wanted to catch a trout in South America, I did all that. You probably don't know this, but in Baltimore, I have my own television show in 59, 60, 61. It was in WBAL, which was on Charles Street at that time. And it was a guy named Bailey Goss and me had this thing. I never drank in my life except occasional wine, but there was a beer called National Bohemian, and they had me hold a bottle this up. I think they called it National Bow, I would hold up and tell them it was wet, cold, and delicious, and I never drank one of them things in my life.
On that note, we're going to take a quick break here before we continue with our hour of stories with outdoorsman Lefty Cray. Still ahead, we're going to hear about the very first time Lefty tried fly fishing, that moment that got him hooked, so to speak. We're going to hear about his adventures as a pioneering saltwater fly fisherman. We'll also find out what a lefty deceiver is and why every good fly fisherman ought to have one in his tackle box. Stay with us.
Okay, this is a graphite rod. It's an 8-weight, which is what you'd use for Chesapeake Bay all the time, and for bass, and for many other bonefish and lots of other species. And it's a weight forward floating line. And we're going to use one that's pretty bright colored so we can see it pretty well. But other than that, it's just a standard piece of fly tackle.
Lefty Cray, doing what he does best, casting fly line and enjoying the great outdoors. Welcome back to a special co-production of The Signal and Maryland Traditions. I'm Aaron Henkin here with folklorist Cliff Murphy. And Cliff, I feel like after spending the day with Lefty, I came away with this idea that, you know, fly fishing compared to regular fishing is sort of like doing calligraphy compared to just writing with a ballpoint pen. It's not the easiest way to get the job done, but it is perhaps the most artful. Does that seem like a fair analogy to you?
I like that because there is an artistry to it. I think the other thing, too, is that fly fishing is an excuse to stand in the middle of a stream all day and just kind of take in the scenery around you. It's interesting to kind of hear Lefty observe changes in life that have happened since 1925, whether it's how much Frederick has changed or, you know, how much the business and the tools of fishing have changed. In 1947, for instance, not many people were doing spin casting, right? That's kind of like the quintessential form of fishing.
That's what most people know as regular fishing.
Yeah, rod and a reel, yeah. Right? So the spin casting was new, and Lefty was doing a bunch of that.
He had actually kind of become a really accomplished fisherman and had been for years before he ever saw a fly reel. And what we're going to hear right now is the story of the first time he ever got to hold a fly reel in his hand and sort of experience the magic of that. And the story here starts with him meeting a journalist, an outdoors columnist by the name of Joe Brooks.
Joe Brooks was writing for the county paper. He became the best known fly fisherman in the world. But at the time, he only was writing for this little tiny county paper down here. And he called me up, and I had gotten a reputation of being sort of a hot dog fisherman, and this Joe Brooks, who I'd never heard about, called and said, I'd like to do a column for you. So he came up. We went just below Harper's Ferry, and I had a 13-foot Luna Grumman canoe. I carried it down, and Joe carried his stuff down. He came down, and I walked and got the rest of the stuff. When I came down, he was putting a fly rod in. I'd never seen a fly rod. Nobody in Western Maryland I knew fly fished.
But you were already a hot dog fisherman at this point, but you'd never seen a fly rod.
Plug tackle, not spinning tackle. And I was using 6-pound test silk lines, which we had to dry every night because they'd rot. I mean, you had to take the line off the reel every night and dry it, or it would rot on you. This was way before all the modern tackle we got now. Well, nobody ever catches as many fish as the local guy on his water, the good guy. Joe didn't catch more fish, but he caught an impressive amount. But I never got a good look at that fly line and thing till we had lunch. And we were down below Harpers Ferry, below Weaverton. We ate lunch, and then he walked up on this cliff, to which I now have just a couple of years ago, took a picture of. It's where I was introduced to fly casting, that I got a guy to take a couple pictures of it. There was little rings out on the water, and what it was, in this time of year, early October, late September, billions and billions of flying ants used to try to fly across, migrate across Potomac, and they fell in by the billions. And these bass were sipping them off the surface. And Joe and I walked up on the top, and he pulled off this fly line. My silk line was about the size of a small woman's needle, real thin stuff. This stuff looked like rope. And he pulled it off, and he had a little black and white fly, which I learned later was a black ghost fly, name of it. And he threw it out there in a ring, and he caught a fish. He threw it another ring. Caught another fish. He did this about 6 or 8 times. I told Joe, I said, I got to have some of this. The next day, I drove to Baltimore in my Model A Ford to Tochterman Sporting Goods Store, which is still there today. And Joe took me over, and I paid for it, but he picked out a fiberglass rod. And in fact, I just recently donated that reel, fly reel, to the American Museum of Fly Fishing. But I caught thousands of fish on that. And he gave me a fly casting lesson and left town the next day. I don't know if that was the reason. But anyway, that's how I got interested. And then I actually got a whole bunch of my buddies and Frederick to get involved in this thing. And eventually it became the Potomac Valley Fly Fishing Club. And then I started teaching it all over the country. And it just went on and on from there.
On and on it continues to go as Lefty Cray, age 90, is still at it, traveling the world, spreading the gospel of fly fishing, and catching some whopper fish along the way, as well as lots of great stories. Aaron Henkin here with Cliff Murphy. And Cliff, Lefty Cray, he really kind of became the world's first bona fide celebrity fisherman, didn't he?
He did, and he's a good one, too.
Yeah, yeah. And he's a pioneer in the field, too. This is a guy who, at one point, he learned how to do fly fishing, got good at it, and then he realized, hey, you can actually do this fly fishing thing in the salt water, too. And we're going to hear a story now about how that new horizon of fly fishing came to be.
It's hard to realize now, but the Chesapeake Bay, this time of the year in October, Eastern Bay, right below the bridge, used to be totally covered up with bracken stripers that were young stripers. They would be 18 to 20 inches, but there would be froth for bigger than football fields of nothing but thousands of stripers that were on the water. And I went down there, and I figured, damn it, you got to catch these on the fly. So I started using popping bugs, and then gradually, I developed a fly called the Lefty Deceiver. Tom Cofield was the outdoor editor for the News American, and Tom and I used to go to Chrisfield. You couldn't do this today, but they had a packing plant right down at the water, and they used to pack crabs. They would pack all these crabs in cans, these ladies. At the end of the day, they took snow shovels and just shoveled all this offal into the water, which, of course, you couldn't do today. Well, it was a gigantic chum line, and these thousands of stripers would come up. I mean, you'd throw a fly out there, it was like rolling a wine bottle in a jail cell. I mean, something was on top of it. The problem was that all our flies had a feather-like wing on them, and it's something on the shank. But if that feather wing got tangled somehow in the hook, even though they were in a frenzy of feeding, they wouldn't take it. So on the way home, I got to talking to Tom that I'm going to develop a fly that is easy to cast, it won't tangle, and it's got the shape of a bait fish. So I developed this white fly called a Deceiver, which is probably one of the 2 or 3 most well-used flies around the world today, called a Lefty Deceiver or just Deceiver. It wasn't a specific fly. It was a specific way of tying a fly. So you could make it small or big. You could change the colors. You could actually change the shape somewhat. And so it became one of the most popular flies in the country, in the world today.
Lefty's Deceiver, famous enough, in fact, Cliff Murphy, to have been immortalized on a U.S. postage stamp.
Right. In 1991, a painting of a Lefty's Deceiver was on a 29-cent stamp. And, you know, Lefty's a funny guy, and he had explained to us that it was a real honor to have his fly on this postage stamp, but that he had to buy his own stamps from the post office.
Yeah, he was miffed. They wouldn't give him he said he got one stamp that was on a little plaque, but it was already affixed to the plaque, so he couldn't use it. He had to buy his own stamps. So, yeah, when you and I spent this day with Lefty, Cliff, I have to say one of the best parts was when he took us upstairs to show us his fly-tying workshop. And this room is like the absolute bane of a fish's existence. This is where Lefty ties together all these little filaments and feathers and hooks to create these flies and minnows that he casts. And really, I mean, how do you describe that workshop in a way that does it justice?
Yeah, it would be, like, if this was a cartoon movie, this would be where the fish somehow gets upstairs and sees the workshop and just
screams in horror.
Yeah. What's kind of amazing about the art of fly tying is that it's not like, let's say, with a duck decoy where you are trying to create a realistic likeness of a bird. With fly tying, you're trying to create something that when it's moving underwater looks to a fish like food.
And just visually, it was stunning in there because there are all these brightly colored, sparkly filaments and bits of flash, and it's like the manliest version you could think of a Michael's craft store.
Right. And meticulously organized.
A miracle of organization in this place. And he's got inventions to perfect his systems in there. He's got a little magnet where he keeps his scissors right there on the light that shines down. He's got these special things that hold his glue containers so that they don't spill when he's using. He's got a special trough for all the little scraps of fibers. And it's just like this ergonomically perfect homemade workstation. We really got an education in that workshop. Lefty was in his element, and he took us to school.
Flies are all sizes. As you can see, these are a couple of these could sit on an aspirin tablet with no trouble. These are supposed to look like insects you're going to eat. This looks like a minnow that would swim in the water. For example, the red on here is supposed to look like the gills on a fish. And when fish come up, they want to see white on the bottom because that's the color of the belly. And then I've never found out why chartreuse works so well, but a saying that I've been using for many years, if it ain't chartreuse, it ain't no use, you know. So the chartreuse in white is one of the best colors in salt and freshwater all over the world, whether it's Argentina or Australia or United States. So what we have here is a fish, this wiggles at the back, and this stuff really shape when it's wet actually forms a bait shape. So the fly design has a lot to do with how it swims in the water or how it looks. Is it a natural thing? Some of the trout flies, the fish are looking up. So with the silhouette of the fly, whether the legs hang down, we put rubber bands on them to make them get more activation in it. Without moving the fly itself, the current will do that. It's something that takes a lifetime to learn. One of the great things about fly fishing, I mean, I've been doing this since 1947, and I still learn things about them.
It must be such a particular kind of sweet satisfaction to catch a fish on a fly that you made yourself.
I think one of the reasons that people like fly tying is that when you're tying flies, you're doing that in the wintertime and all when you can't go fishing. And then in the spring, where am I going to go? You're planning your trips and everything. Then you go to the stream, and then you decide, are these fish taking nymphs, which are something under the water? Are they taking emergers, which is a fly that's just coming out? Or are they taking dry flies that are on the surface? If it's a dry fly, is it, what size is it? Roughly what color is it? And now I've got to get to it so that when I make the cast, the fly is going to drift drag-free to the fish. So I have to, how can I get across these currents? These are all factors that go in to, you haven't even made a cast yet. Eventually you get to the point where I can make the cast and I've got to make sure that the cast is right and that the leader's going to have limp in the front end so it floats at the current, and then the fish takes a fly. Even a 12-inch fish is a lot of fun when you catch it that way.
It really is a work of art, these things. So, I mean, once
it's a lot of fun. Well, if you're
good, science and art together.
Yeah, but you can make this fly in about maybe 4 or 5 minutes if you're good. And it is. It's an art form in a way, but it's the most relaxing thing I've ever done. I can be writing a book or something and come over and tie flies for a while and forget all about it for a little bit.
It seems like really rewinding back to a more primordial thing, right? Because you're making this really delicate, beautiful object, but it's tied to survival, and it's tied to, like, the idea of being a hunter and tricking your prey, and it just seems really kind of, like, visceral that way.
One of the things that attracts so many people to bonefish, and I've caught over 125 species on a fly, and it's my favorite, is that you get on a boat or you wade, and you're going across these pristine shallow flats in the tropics, and you're hunting and you're looking, and these fish are silver sided so that they reflect the bottom over which they swim. It's almost like putting a mirror on sideways, a vertical on the water. You put it down on the bottom, it's going to reflect the water. So they're very hard to see. You're spotting these fish, and they're, everything in salt water is getting eaten up by something bigger than it, so they ain't going to hang around long. And so you're moving along, and these fish are moving, and you're trying to locate them. And then when you see them, you've got about maybe 10 seconds to make a cast. The cast has to be at the right spot in front of them. It has to get down near the bottom because their mouth's on the bottom, and they got to feed on the bottom. You have to strip it a certain way. And then if they take it, you got to set the hook. And then you got the problem of landing the fish at your hook. So it's really hunting, and lots of fishing is hunting and fishing.
You're tuned to a special co-production of The Signal and Maryland Traditions. More big fish stories when our program continues. Stay with us.
Most fly fishermen only use their arm and their wrist to cast with. And for many years, I've maintained that even in ping pong, you use your body. So I maintain that you use your whole body to cast with, and it makes so much less effort. And at almost 90, I'm still fishing all the time, and I can fish for. I was in Wisconsin a few weeks ago, fishing 7 hours a day and not tired. But the two people with me who were just using their wrist and arm in the conventional casting way, we're very tired at the end of the thing. So I think you'll see more. It's better to watch it. I think it's difficult to explain.
Audio there from a beautiful, sunny, cool fall day outdoors with world-renowned fly fisherman Lefty Cray near his home in Cockeysville, Maryland. You're tuned to a special co-production of The Signal and Maryland Traditions. I'm Aaron Henkin here with folklorist Cliff Murphy. We're sharing some highlights from a day of stories, philosophy, and no small amount of fishing instruction from Lefty. And I have to say, Cliff, did you ever notice that none of Lefty's fish stories were ever actually really about fish?
Right. It's like, somebody who's an incredible chef and their stories really ultimately are about their dinner guests than, you know, more about the dinner guests than they are about the dinner.
Yeah, nicely put. Yeah. I want to play one of those kinds of stories right now. This is a great example of a fishing story that's not about fish at all.
In 1961, I went to Belize and we took a boat 30 miles offshore to a place called Eternif Islands. These kind of experiences are what make it interesting for me. I fished with a little guide who was only about 5'2", named Philip, an older person. And I mentioned to him I caught a lot of snook, but never caught a really monster snook. So this was about snook. And so he helped me catch a 42.5-inch snook, which is still the biggest I ever caught out of many hundreds. I went home. I came back the next year. Philip was still there. And Philip told me a wonderful story, and this involved a snook. He said that he and his little boy, in 1961, they didn't have many motorboats. They had sailboats. They had one big post up with a big sail on it. He sailed 30 miles from Belize out to the Eternif Islands, and he was commercial fishing. and didn't realize a hurricane was coming. So he realized that he couldn't make it back. So they ran up into one of the Mangrove Island creeks and anchored the boat. Well, that Turnip Islands are mostly mangrove islands. There's not much land. And the storm surge came over the top, defolded all the trees, and sunk the boat. And he held his little boy in his arms for hours with water up to his chest before the surge went down. Took him 4 days to get back to get the boat refloated and get back to public city. He tied the boat up to city dock. He's walking up the street, and here came his wife at a funeral procession for him and his son. She passed out in the middle of the street.
That is a fishing story worth telling and retelling over a lifetime, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like something out of a Mark Twain novel. Yeah. Again, this is back at the beginning of the show. You asked me what draws someone like me, a folklorist, to somebody like Lefty Cray, and it is this, it's all of these layers of craft and storytelling and of, you know, community memory and all these things, just one on top of the other on top of the other.
Cliff Murphy, Maryland Traditions folklorist that you are, when we visited with Lefty, you seemed particularly interested in talking with him about the future of this specialty of his, fly fishing. Do you think his sport is in danger of becoming a lost tradition?
It seems like the biggest threat to the tradition is really an environmental one. And that is the message that Lefty brings from his experiences in the 1920s and 30s to the future, really, which is that he has observed the world around him changed. He has witnessed rivers, streams, oceans, the Chesapeake Bay become transformed by pollution and by overdevelopment and these sorts of things, so that they would be unrecognizable to his peers from the 1920s and 30s. The biodiversity that existed then doesn't exist anymore.
I think all fishing, freshwater fishing, is suffering from some problems. One is liability. It used to be that if you wanted to hunt or fish on a farmer's land right here in Maryland, if you went up and asked permission, they would let you do it. What they were concerned about is that you would not leave the gates open so their cattle wouldn't get out and you wouldn't run over their cornfields and stuff like that. Well, people started suing people for falling in a hole or ludicrous things. I mean, so liability has gotten so that it's reduced the amount of access for any kind of fishing, fly fishing, spin fishing, whatever. The other thing is that the younger people, Tom Brokaw wrote a book recently and he was telling me about it. And he said the theme of it is that older people work for what they needed. Young people work for what they want. I just heard this morning on the news that something like 16% of the average family's money now is taken out of other things and gone toward the internet stuff. Think about it. If you got a modern family with two kids or three kids, they've all got an iPhone. So they're oriented toward not doing anything except being at home. They're not. Everybody used to play outdoors. Most kids today don't want to go outdoors. So we're having that kind of a problem. And then we've got a problem with the fisheries. Our fisheries are nowhere. I mean, 20 miles of the upper Potomac is a dead zone. I mean, of the Chesapeake Bay is a dead zone today because the Chesapeake Bay is the sunken river mouth of the Susquehanna. The Susquehanna used to have the mouth down in Virginia. That sunk eons ago to form Chesapeake Bay. Susquehanna is considered one of the most endangered rivers in the United States today by the Sierra Club and others. All of that sewage, all of that fertilizer, all that stuff coming down is killing Chesapeake Bay. The lower end of the bay isn't a problem. It's the upper bay. We're depleting our fishery resource. So we have to, the big thing is that I don't think we're going to clean up our rivers and all until they become our drinking sources. People, young people, are not interested in preserving. They're interested in their iPhones and their iPads and that sort of thing. But they don't realize what they had, so they're not really working to get it back.
At 90 years old, Lefty Cray has certainly earned the right to his perspective. He's seen a lot change socially, and culturally and environmentally since 1925. Aaron Henkin here with folklorist Cliff Murphy. We're sharing highlights from a day we spent on site with Lefty at his home in Cockeysville, Maryland. And as we get ready to wrap up the program, I want to play this final reflection from Lefty about the camaraderie of fly fishing. You know, he points out that there are not fly fishing tournaments. It's not about numbers. It's not about the sizes of fish. It's about camaraderie.
If you're on a stream fishing and you don't know much about fly fishing, and there's a guy above you that you've never met before who's a fly fisherman, and he's catching fish and you ain't, he'll probably walk down and say, these are the flies that I'm using, and maybe you ought to try one of these. And there's a camaraderie that is different about fly fishing. The other thing is that when you cast, you can't see the line with spinning or plug. You can't even see the plug most of the time. It's an invisible connection between you and the fish. With fly fishing, you actually see the line unroll. You're monitoring the whole time that's in flight, and you don't cast flies, you unroll them. What's pulling the line is that loop unrolling in front of you, and you watch that, and it's pretty to see. You don't see fly spin casters and plug casters going out on a lawn just throwing lures, but you'll see fly castmen, whole groups of them, get out and cast together. It's a whole different philosophy, and you don't have to. I'll be 90 in a couple months, and I'm going to be in Louisiana in 2 weeks fishing with guys half my age. You can do this as long as you are alive, really.
That's going to wrap it up for this special co-production of The Signal and Maryland Traditions. I'm Aaron Henkin. I've been here this hour with folklorist Cliff Murphy. And Cliff, any final thoughts before we sign off on fly fishing, life, and the universe in general?
Well, I mean, one is that I hope that when I'm in my late 80s that I'm as lively and engaged and active as Lefty Cray. And that, I have a deep admiration for somebody like him who, I mean, this is a man who has a high school education who speaks to power. He's somebody who is a remarkable steward of tradition, culture, and society.
I personally want to thank you, Cliff, for introducing me to Lefty. It was a pleasure to meet him and to put this program together with you. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Aaron.
You can hear this program in its entirety on demand at wypr.org/programs/signal. That's also where you can see some really beautiful pictures from our day that we spent with Lefty Cray, photos taken by Edwin Remsburg. The website again, wypr.org/programs/signal. I want to mention also that Lefty Cray is about to be honored with a Maryland Traditions Alta Award. That's an award for achievements in living traditions and arts. The award ceremony happens on the evening of Saturday, December 6th at the Montgomery College Cultural Arts Center. And you can find details for that event online at the Maryland State Arts Council website, msac.org. For 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station, I'm Aaron Henkin. Thanks for listening.
Stop, stop. You look like a monkey hoeing cabbage. Okay, first thing we want to do is you want to keep your thumb, don't raise your elbow. You hold the rod with me once and let me forget the left hand. Now, if we take this straight back, no, you're bending, let me do it.
Okay.
Don't bend the wrist and pivot the body. See it? See it? What you're doing is this. See it?